Now with the last discussion item on our agenda, and that is the report of the Commission for Impartial Courts, the implementation plan. And we're very pleased to have with us my colleague, Justice Ming Chin, who's chair of the Commission for Impartial Courts Implementation Committee, as he was of the initial task force. Let me first, before I go on to the other presenters, indicate how much we appreciate that in addition to having a very active role in your day job, that you've undertaken many other matters, being in charge of our technology efforts, specifically the case management system project, as well as science and the law, as well as this commission. So we very much appreciate your involvement and follow-up on this initial excellent report with an implementation plan, so this doesn't end up just being a report that gathers dust on the shelves, but that we see it through to action. So thank you very much for that. And also, we're very pleased to have with us Judge Bill McLaughlin, who's a former distinguished member of the Judicial Council and is the chair of the Task Force on Judicial Campaign Finance and a former presiding judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court, and our own Chris Patton. And let me take this occasion to point out that the three regional directors assume, in addition to their very important role satisfying the constituents within their respective regions, other projects, and this is a prime example of it, with Chris being staff to this important commission. But in addition to that, she has, on an acting basis, taken on yet the third and fourth hat, I guess we could say, being, in view of Marcia Taylor's departure, acting head of appellate court services, which involves managing our efforts with regard to the Administrative Presiding Justices Committee and the Court of Appeal Executive Officers, and also being involved in that assignment with the Assigned Judges Program, which entails now more than 400 judges, and also the Court-Appointed Counsel Program, and I believe you also are involved in the Community Corrections Initiative. So for wearing all those multiple hats, we appreciate what you do and your fellow regional directors in assuming these additional duties. All right, Justice Chin, I'll turn it over to you for your presentation. And thank you for your patience in sitting through our discussion of the matter of audits. Now we get to your program on a different level. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. It's always a pleasure to be in front of the council, I think. Chris called me a half hour ago and said that you are ahead of schedule. I knew she was wrong.
We fixed that.
I do want to thank Chris for her outstanding work, not just for this commission, but for the many other services she provides the judicial branch. We also have with us Chad Finke. We could not have done this without Chad. He has just been superb, not in just doing the final report, but in doing this first batch of recommendations for the council. He has worked long hours and on very short notice, but has done a terrific job. I see a couple of new faces. I will not go into a lot of detail, but you all know that there are challenges to impartiality. The attacks on the judiciaries across the country, the influence of politics in many judicial elections, the rapid rise in campaign contributions, and, of course, the television attack-type ads that we have shown you many times in this chamber. That prompted the chief to call a judicial summit in November of 2006, it was a very detailed discussion from judicial and bar leaders across the state. And out of that came the Commission for Impartial Courts, which the chief appointed in 2007. It had 88 outstanding members. Many of the members of this council participated. Four task forces, steering committee. We had four excellent consultants. It took 2 years to do this study. We had a public forum at which former governors Gray Davis and Pete Wilson spoke. We had people from the media. It was a good discussion. The members of the commission have spoken many times in many different groups about the work of the commission while the work was ongoing. All of our meetings were open to the public. At our last meeting, we had a public comment section. So we have tried to keep this in focus, not just for the council, but for all of the people of California. Just last week, I spoke at a seminar at Hastings Law School called Democracy and the Courts, Judicial Selection, Legal Literacy, and the Role of Public Opinion. They have just asked me to publish my remarks in the next issue of the Hastings Law Journal. I said I'm going to have to clean them up a bit, but I will do that. As you know, we made 71 recommendations to you at the December meeting. The four task forces, campaign conduct, campaign finance, judicial selection and retention, public information and education. Now, you all know that there are now 70 recommendations. The Supreme Court has taken one of them off the table with Citizens United. We said that we should not have campaign contributions from labor unions and corporations. The U.S. Supreme Court disagreed. The effect of that decision remains to be seen. But all the judges in California, will have to react to whatever happens as a result of campaign contributions from those entities. I ask you to remain flexible. I don't know what is going to happen. I talked to Bert Brandenburg last week of the Justice at Stake. We talked about going to corporations and asking for corporate responsibility. We might go to labor unions and ask for labor union responsibility. I'm not terribly optimistic. I think there's always going to be some group financed by some corporation or some labor union that's going to wreak havoc in our judicial elections. As I said before, we're going to have to remain flexible as to how we react to that. I think it could be a very serious problem. Now, at the December meeting, of course, you received and accepted our report. You directed Bill Vickery to provide for a list of priorities and an implementation plan. The committee has attempted to do that. Again, Chief, you have supplied me with an outstanding group of people to work with. In addition to the four task force chairs, we have three members of the council. Tani, Dennis, and Brad. As you all know, these are top-caliber people. I am delighted to be working with them. To them, we've added three attorneys, Joe Dunn from Orange County, Chris Plord from San Diego, and we thought that we should have a member of the State Bar Board of Governors. So we've added Patricia White, who is also an outstanding member of the steering committee. The implementation committee met January 4th. Our priorities were these. Don't bring anything to the council at the beginning that has a price tag. They will come later if the financial picture improves. We wanted to look at implementing things that were already underway. We wanted to look at what other entities were willing to do, and we wanted to look at what legislative action was a possibility. At the chief state of the outstanding state of the judiciary speech in Sacramento this week, two people approached me, one from the Office of Governmental Affairs, and she said that legislators are already approaching her about wanting to implement legislation to start some of our proposals down the road. Assemblyman Paul Fong from the Silicon Valley is a new member of the Assembly. He's from one of the community colleges. He's a political science professor at one of the community colleges in the Silicon Valley, and he said, let me know whether I can help you with the legislation involving education. So we've already begun some of the processes, and all these will eventually come together. The proposed timeline that we want to give to you today, and I again ask you to be flexible. Today's meeting, Bill is going to talk about the disclosure and disqualification recommendations that came from his task force on campaign finances. By the April meeting, we hope to have to you recommendations regarding amending the judicial ethics, defining impartiality, of course, encouraging judges to participate in this public education process, much like the Supreme Court has done with our outreach program. By the summer of this year, we hope to have recommendations to you regarding civic education, judicial outreach, and public information. By the fall of this year, we hope to have recommendations relating to judicial campaign conduct. The winter meeting, we will have before you the legislative action. Now, the last one is the catch-all in 2011 and beyond. Hopefully by then, we will be able to talk to you about money. We'll see. I want to thank the chief and the council for appointing the implementation committee. They are terrific, again, terrific people to work with. And besides, I don't have enough work to do anyway. I now turn the chair over to Bill McLaughlin, the chair of the Task Force on Campaign Finance, to talk about the three specific proposals that Bill and the steering committee eventually presented to the council. As I was thinking about how to introduce Bill, I remember that I at our last dinner, Bill got a cocktail delivered to his table by a friendly admirer, and it had all kinds of things sticking out of it, umbrellas and strawberries. And, I mean, it looked like a fruit salad. So I took out my cell phone and took a picture of Bill. So I thought I'd show it to you today.
No, I'm not. Which means I have to do exactly what he says.
With that introduction, we toast your return to us.
Bill?
Mr. Justice Chin, thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the council, just very briefly, each of the three recommendations we brought to you today are ones which are a product of what I told you when we were here in December could be fairly summarized as disclose and disqualify. But before I get to those, I just wanted to read you a quote from a program, a participant in a program was on national television, I think it was February 19th. There must be a recommitment, a rededication to the Constitution in every generation. And every generation faces a different challenge. We weren't talking about this 30 years ago. That's referring to the effect of money in elections, and specifically judicial elections, because we didn't have money in elections. Money in elections presents us with a tremendous challenge, a tremendous problem, and we are remiss if we don't at once address it and correct it. Does anyone know who said that? Bill Moyer's journal program? He's the author of the United Citizens decision for the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy. United Citizens decision is one which I think highlights the reasons that we brought these recommendations. And remembering the timeline of the course of the work of the commission as just recited to us by Justice Chin, we were talking about these issues of the effect of money, how to address it, beginning in really in 2006 and certainly when the commission began its full agenda and work in 2007. So during these discussions, the Caperton case was wandering through the West Virginia courts, had not yet even reached the West Virginia Supreme Court, and United Citizens was simply working on the movie that they were hoping to show on cable TV. Now with United Citizens telling us that that those provisions of the McCain-Feingold Act, which restrict the use of corporate treasury funds in contributions to independent expenditure committees, are unconstitutional. Now, that was actually the holding of the case. The implications for probably go far beyond it. But that case, that decision, which some have said may open the floodgates of money into judicial elections, certainly causes us to reflect on and also to think about what we were told in the Caperton case. Caperton, if you recall when it was decided, was the subject of a great deal of comment. And the gist of a large part of that comment was the Caperton case didn't really tell us very much. All it held was that a $3 million contribution by the defendant in the case, the CEO Blankenship of Massey Energy, to one of the Supreme Court, West Virginia Supreme Court justices, who then failed and refused to recuse himself, violated due process. So the question was, what other amount, if any, would also violate due process? All we really know is $3 million apparently does. Now, I wasn't here yesterday afternoon for the meeting that you all had, the discussion with Dean Starr and Chemerinsky, but I have been told that at least one of them, and I don't remember which it was, apparently expressed the observation, at least, that Justice Kennedy might be very satisfied to deal with the effect of money in judicial elections on an ad hoc basis. Ad hoc in the sense that you'd wait and see retrospectively whether the amount of a contribution violated due process. In other words, we know that $3 million apparently does. Will $2.5 million violate due process? Will it be $2 million? And we don't know. Now, we considered that in our task force. We considered that issue. And our answer to it is different than has been given to us so far by the U.S. Supreme Court. Our approach and the three recommendations we brought to you here today is really a bright line approach. And that gets us to the disclose and disqualify. The recommendations 29, 30, and 33, certainly in our opinion, of the 70, originally 71 recommendations, now, as Justice Chin said, down to 70 because of the United Citizens case, more than most of the others, we think, present a significant impact on the preservation of impartial judiciary, and that's one of the reasons that we brought them here for you today. There are other reasons as well, which we'll get to, but they do include the fact that they can be referred to another entity, the Supreme Court, for referral to their Committee on Judicial Ethics for review, because for each of these, we're recommending that they be addressed through amendments to and of the canons. They can also be implemented with de minimis cost, and that was also one of the things we looked at in putting together the timeline in the implementation committee. The cost really is de minimis nature, and Chad will excuse me for referring to him as de minimis nature. Chad's the one who puts it together, and really the only expenditure we're going to have will be the staff time and being able to put together the package for referral and then in putting together whatever response we get to be able to take it to fruition. As I already mentioned, we think these recommendations, each of them, are timely in light of the Caperton decision and the Citizens United condition, And so the decision. So the first of our recommendations is number 29. And this is the one which would require trial court judges to disclose campaign contributions of $100 or more. Campaign contributions, where applicable, meaning a judge who's been through an election where funds were raised, will be available in the courthouse or online or both, and that the judicial officer will have an obligation to disclose for a minimum of 2 years from receipt of assuming office or from the receipt or assuming office, whichever is later. And the reason that we added that language is that sometimes in all political campaigns, and it certainly is true, I've noted in judicial election campaigns, sometimes they continue collecting money after the campaign is over. And we wanted to make sure that the duty to disclose would continue for at least a two-year period from the time that the contribution is received, and certainly in any event from the time that the term of office begins. The rationale for this is that we think that public trust can be achieved without contribution limits. I'll talk in a moment about why we chose this approach as opposed to contribution limits. And the amount itself, the $100, is an amount we selected because it's what a candidate must now report to the FPPPC pursuant to the Government Code section shown to you on the monitor. The time period, the two-year period, incidentally, is also consistent with the CJA ethics opinion number 48, which I think was in 1999, about 10 or 11 years ago. The next recommendation has to do with number 30, and this requires mandatory disqualification of a trial court judge when a contribution of $1,500 or more has been made to the campaign by a party or someone associated or with the party or attorney appearing before the judicial officer. The amount itself, after a great deal of debate, by the way, the debate ran from zero to $250,000 when we were having the discussion. But the amount we eventually selected and are recommending to you is related to that amount contained in CCP section 170.5 sub B, and that's the in connection with 170.1 of the CCP, where it says you should disqualify yourself for financial interest. Then the financial interest is defined in 170.5. Financial interest in simpler terms, without worrying about closely held corporations and so on, is a $1,500 interest, typically of stock or bond. The other issue related to this, which we think is of great importance, as with all of the recommendations, is for what time these obligations would continue. And in this, we also have recommended that it be for the two-year period of time, the same as for the disclosure. Now, it's also important, I think, not only as part of the recommendations, but also as we go forward and we continue to educate and advise judges of their obligations in this area, to point out that these recommendations would not reduce or eliminate the obligation of a judicial officer to disqualify themselves in connection with CCP section 170.1 sub A, sub 6, sub A. And that's the provision which says you should recuse yourself if there's an appearance of partiality or for any other reason that would cause someone to question the impartiality of the judicial officer. And it very well may be that there would be a situation where a judicial officer would choose to recuse themselves, even if they had a $25 contribution from somebody. It does occur to be, and it did to us in the discussion, that's probably likely in the trial court and probably in the Court of Appeal, but not necessarily the Supreme Court, that you might very well choose to disqualify yourself in any matter in which a contributor is appearing before you, no matter how small or large the amount might be. Chances are pretty good in trial court fundraising that the contributors are persons that are pretty well known to you. So we emphasize throughout and do in our recommendations to you that we continue to support and agree with the duty to disqualify in accordance with 170.1. But we also wanted to draw a bright, clear line so there'd be certainty as to what the obligation would be under any kind of circumstance. And that's the major distinction between what we're recommending and what has been given to us now in the Caperton case, what we think is a creation of a bright, clear line. The mandatory disqualification, as with a financial interest otherwise of stock or bonds, is one which would be waivable by the non-contributing party under the same terms and conditions as presently it may be waived, the main one being that the judicial officer should not solicit people to a litigant to waive this potential conflict, but that if the subject arises and the parties on there or the non-contributing party on their own makes the decision that they're willing to waive otherwise mandatory disqualification, they may do so, and that that this duty would continue for the 2 years as stated. Now, the rationale behind the recommendation for mandatory disqualification is that basically disqualification is more effective than the contribution limits. You know, it was some years ago when they began discussing both at the federal and state level contribution limits that the idea was that they wanted to reduce the effect of money on decision-making, whether it be legislative, executive, or judicial. And at the time, it certainly seemed like a good idea. But as Justice Chin pointed out, it seems that wherever money can go, it finds a way to get there. And what happened with contribution limits, both on the federal and state level, is that it encouraged the growth of independent expenditures. And that growth has been exponential. In the state of California, since the contribution limits were imposed approximately 10 years ago, there's been I've forgotten the exact number, and Chad can probably remind me, but something like a 600% increase in the volume of money contributed for independent expenditures. And so, and there's a problem. There's another problem with independent expenditures. Well, California does have a very comprehensive law on the disclosure of the source of money for independent expenditures. It's not as easy a trail to follow as would be a reporting by a judicial officer of the contributions received. And now, understanding from experience that contribution limits have simply caused the money to go elsewhere, to take a different course, it seemed to us that we can still accomplish the same purpose by requiring the disqualification, creating a disconnect between the contribution of the contributing party and the judicial decision maker, which was the idea behind contribution limits in the first place, and that we can do it without forcing money into independent expenditures, which becomes increasingly important now in light of the United Citizens case, because the United Citizens case has opened the floodgates. Corporate treasury funds and union treasury funds, now according to the U.S. Supreme Court, can be contributed without limitation to independent expenditure committees that engage in express advocacy. Express advocacy, without going through all the technical portions of the definition, basically are ones which are designed for and expressly do advocate for or against a candidate or a particular proposition or idea that may be on the ballot. We think that that the disqualification, the combination of disclosure and qualification, is what will enhance public trust and confidence, because we are not going to leave it beyond a certain point to a judicial officer's discretion as to whether or not they should recuse themselves from the case. We also thought, after we talked about varying amounts and how to do this, how to fashion this level of disqualification, that, again, a bright, clear line, that is a specific sum of money, was probably more advisable for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's more consistent with the present structure of both the Code of Civil Procedure as well as the judicial canons. And also anything else became quite cumbersome. As an example, $500 contribution in Los Angeles judicial race might not be considered to be a particularly significant sum. In Dennis Murray's county, it might be. I don't know. But we did consider and look at whether or not the level of disqualification ought to be, for example, a certain percentage of the contributed monies received. We looked at the formula of what would you do with counties with a population in excess of 5 million people, guess who that would be, and creating a scale where we could create a scale of relative value, but decided this is really a lot more confusing than it ought to be. And the state legislature has already, in the Code of Civil Procedure and the Supreme Court, through the promulgation of the canons of judicial ethics, have taken the approach of a bright, clear line, and that was eventually what we decided should be done. Recommendation number 33 applies to disqualification in the courts of appeal and at the Supreme Court. As to the Court of Appeal Justice, we again had quite a discussion over what the amount that would trigger the mandatory disqualification should be, again, with quite a wide range of discussion. But we eventually settled upon the $1,500, which is currently provided by the canons for disqualification at the appellate level. And that, again, for reasons of consistency. At the Supreme Court, as you know, in December, when I mentioned, I've had no response either from Chief Justice, and Justice Chin has remained silent on the subject. In other words, he let our task forces have our way. We had a much more vigorous debate as to whether or not there should be mandatory disqualification, and even if there was, what should the level be. The monitor shows us that what we eventually decided upon was a mandatory disqualification based on the contribution limit to a candidate for governor. It isn't presently $20,000. The number right now is $25,900. And this is established from time to time by the government code section shown to you on the monitor. Now, there's a slight inconsistency, I suppose, in creating a different standard for the Court of Appeal and basing it on something which is a world we don't want to go into, which is elective politics, even though Justice Scalia continues to remind us that we are political beings. And the reason primarily for breaking from the $1,500 contribution limit was that at the Supreme Court level, an office, the only one of the three levels of courts that has a statewide jurisdiction, that we recognize not only from what's happening elsewhere in the country, but even past history in the state of California, even though it has been quite a while since we've had a legitimately contested retention election at the Supreme Court level, that substantial amounts of money are involved. And so, if you want to ask some questions, Bob, I have further debate, but I'd like to just finish this up for you to say we eventually settled on the limit of the contribution limit for a candidate for the governor's position. Again, paying attention to, and I think some homage to what the legislature has already decided, is a level where they felt that a disconnect should occur between the contribution of money and the expected actions that would occur.
But you didn't want to have a sliding scale, I gather, and that's why you...
That's right. We didn't...
Take that amount.
You know, Chief, we had a lot of discussion over this, and again, we thought about that as well. Fortunately, we're less likely to have this happen in California than many other states because of retention elections. The real money that's been spent in Supreme... First of all, most of the money that's spent on judicial elections is spent at the Supreme Court level for obvious reason. That's where the last word is spoken. Most of the money that's spent in judicial elections occurs in those states that have contested appellate elections, not where there are retention elections. So by the very nature of the structure that we already had in place, we're less likely to have this happen than would occur in other places. But the fact it's less likely doesn't mean to us that we shouldn't address it. And it has happened in California. It happened 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's something that the specter remains, and we felt that we needed to address it. And also, again, even if it never comes into play, it seemed to us that there was a symmetry to apply this to all levels of judicial elections to demonstrate to the public, above all, that the state of California and the judiciary were committed to attempting to eliminate the effect of contributions to judicial decisions. So we're not suggesting that a Supreme Court justice would only disqualify themselves if they got a contribution of more than 25.9. And in fact, if I remember correctly, at one time Justice Chin, who I think thought he may be subject to some challenge retention election, had made the policy decision, as did the chief, if I remember correctly, that you're going to recuse yourself in a case involving any level of contribution. That remains in the canons. And again, I think in everything we do in educating the public and educating our judges, we'll need to continue to emphasize to them that they do have this level of discretion, and they must do, and we encourage them all to do what is the right thing under the circumstances of the case. But we want to avoid the situation such as in Capern, and frankly, it's unimaginable to me that someone wouldn't have disqualified themselves for $3 million, but somebody didn't. And so, again, at both levels, both the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court, we have the other same recommendations that the mandatory disqualification can be waived by a non-contributing party, that the obligation to disqualify begins 2 years from the date the contribution is received or the retention date, whichever is later. The sum of all of these is that for each of these recommendations, we can begin to do something which may be the clearest act we can take in trying to eliminate the influence of money on judicial elections, and we can do so. In doing so, we think we can greatly enhance the public's confidence in what the courts are doing. And the impact of this is that we can do it with little cost, other than my volunteering Chad's time, actually. and Chris. Chris has been a great part of this, too, for the certain amount of time necessary for the referral and for the return. We therefore are asking the council to, first of all, accept the prioritization plan. We're asking you to endorse the recommendations that we've made on numbers 29, 30, and 33, and that you ask this to be referred to the Supreme Court, or you move for this to be referred to the Supreme Court for consideration by its advisory committee on the Code of Judicial Ethics. The question mark means that if you have any questions at all, Justice Chinnan told me he'll be very happy to respond.
I'll make one observation just in terms of the process, because there's a certain amount of lack of knowledge, perhaps understandably, in terms of how the ethics process proceeds. What is not always realized is that the California Constitution by reason of an amendment several years ago, and it was not at the behest of the Supreme Court, but it did confer upon the California Supreme Court the responsibility for promulgating Code of Judicial Conduct, and we take that responsibility very seriously. We do have an advisory committee that gives these matters study, any matters affecting the Code of Judicial Conduct, and then the court specifically acts on these recommendations that come to it for changes after the committee, the advisory committee, has evaluated those. And we, as I say, vote individually, we conference it, and we will have the opportunity to hear from you, Judge McLaughlin, in addition, of course, to Justice Chin as a participant in our deliberations before we take final action. So I just want to emphasize that this is something that's not just a study with some esoteric recommendations. It's something that the court will have studied by its own committee and then will vote individually with all seven of us around the conference table.
Right. I'd also like to add along that line, you know, in recommending that we proceed in that manner, we, of course, considered the possibility of a recommendation that we seek legislation, because at the present time, of course, the CCP does cover, certainly for trial court judges, the rules for disqualification the canons cover the appellate court justices. But we thought about the possibility, again, for symmetry of making recommendation that we go to the legislature. But in discussing this with OGA and OGC and among others, and also in keeping in mind the criteria for what we would bring to you and the order in which we would bring it to you, our decision was that we can accomplish this ourselves within the branch. And it will probably go to an audience with a higher level of understanding and sophistication of these issues to begin with. And the result of whatever they choose to do, if they adopt these recommendations either in their present form or some modified form, it will have the same force and effect for all of us. And so while there is quite a process involved in any amendments and changes to the canons, it seemed to us that this, for a variety of these reasons, this was the better course for us to follow, and that's why we're making that recommendation.
No, it's a course of action that allows for more flexibility and adjustment to change circumstances. Once something is in legislation, as in so many other areas, it's much more difficult to adapt than it is through a rules change. Now, that's not to indicate in any way that there isn't a full opportunity for public comment. We'll have matters out there, and we'll receive a lot of comment from judges. I'm sure that the California Judges Association will want to weigh in on any and all of these changes as well. But in the end, it will be the Supreme Court's final determination what action to take after considering not only the Commission's recommendations, but all the public input and the study by our advisory committee. I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that process. Now, are there questions of our presenters?
Yes, thank you, Chief. CJA has weighed in on, I think, almost all of the original recommendations. And let me say it was a pleasure to serve on the task force under Judge McLaughlin, my former PJ. I used to say that he was the one who got me involved in court leadership until he stopped. He told me to stop telling people that.
Well, you were an embarrassment.
Let me say, on a personal level, not for CJ, but on a personal level, I appreciate all of this work. You know, when critics of Caperton say, well, what's the line? You know, this is the answer. It's judges going out and establishing these rules, and I hope that not only in California, but throughout the country, in response to that Supreme Court decision, we start doing that and taking responsibility for ourselves and making these rules. I can also say that on all three of the rules that were presented by Judge McLaughlin, CJA had input, and a lot of those issues were addressed. One issue that I hope is part of the Supreme Court's further discussion is the one of public agencies and when groups of DAs or public defenders, individual DAs, give money to judges in elections, when that reaches that threshold, what happens then? Also on the civil side, what happens when members of the consumer attorneys, for example, does that mean that whenever another member of the consumer attorney appears before you, we know when a DA gives it to us because your occupation is required under the FPPC rules, so we know when we've gotten $1,500 from a district attorney's office, and does that mean that we now are precluded from hearing any criminal cases where the district attorney's or the public defender's office is part? So, and I know that Chad did and the staff did extraordinary work, not only in looking at the legal parts of this, but the practical application, that is, what has happened in the past, and do an analysis of what or the source of money in judicial elections in California. That was a lot of work, and you all did it very, very well, and you should be commended for that. But those issues remain, and CJA will weigh in again on those issues, but we certainly appreciate the opportunity to have weighed in and the great work that Justice Chin and the task force has done. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Let me just comment on that we did discuss these issues, and in our report, which you previously received, and also for the presentation for today, we recognize that these are issues. Our wording, our specific wording when we're talking about contributions, was the money received directly or indirectly. And in that discussion, for those of you who had a chance to focus on that, we mentioned that we think a judicial officer has the obligation for a disqualification when a contribution reaches a certain level, even if it's indirect. And what we were referring to there is that if there is an advocacy group, an independent expenditure committee, however, that is engaged in direct advocacy in your behalf, that if a judicial officer reasonably should be aware of that, that they then would have the obligation to disqualify themselves. We also had a great deal of discussion over this issue of congregation of contributions. And that is something that still needs to be answered. Our discussion generally was that it may not be truer in the more rural counties, but in Los Angeles it's pretty difficult to know who many of the people are, at least what their affiliations may be, that are contributing to your campaign. But certainly if you received, just as an example, without singling them out, if a candidate received a contribution from Latham & Watkins, our view was that that then there would be a mandatory disqualification, assuming it was $1,500 or more, would have the mandatory obligation to disqualify. And the real question is, suppose 10 partners of Latham & Watkins all give you $151, and what do you do with that? So there are some issues yet to be resolved. Although I think our general sense within the committee, Mike, as I know you know, was that probably no duty. You would have the duty to. You may or may not recuse yourself. Remember that the duty to recuse exists regardless of what we're recommending, and the judicial officer might very well make the decision, disregarding these contributions, that under those circumstances they should recuse. But if they don't think that that's called for, they might make the decision that because no one of the contributions exceeds the amount, they wouldn't have to disqualify. Now, as a practical matter, that isn't going to happen. Because even when those large firms appear, while they appear in the names of the attorneys, you'll notice on the pleadings that there's always the firm name as well. And once that firm name is there, as far as we're concerned, there's probably going to be a duty to disqualify. But that remains for discussion.
Line drawing is always a difficult task in any sphere, but I guess to quote Justice Potter Stewart, in a hopefully not too analogous area of pornography, do what he thought. I think $3 million probably.
You know, everyone wants to get to lunch, but I still haven't heard from you, Chief, or from Justice Chin about what you think of the contribution limit recommended for judicial officers of the Supreme Court.
I have it under submission.
I want to tell you, Bill, that the chief and I had another solution to this problem. Anyone who appeared in front of us, we did not think it appropriate that we continue to recuse ourselves. I mean, there's a very limited number of cases that we hear, but we simply return the checks. If anyone had matters in front of us, we return the checks rather than recusing ourselves. And it makes it very hard to fundraise, but that's all right.
And you did have the problem, which you alluded to, Bill, of a large law firm and, you know, one or two individuals give, and, you know, how far does the duty to
That may be an area where we won't have a bright, clear line. I think what we have recommended is going to give us a bright, clear line in nearly all the circumstances that we encounter. But like many bright, clear lines, there may be some parts that are not quite so bright and not quite so clear under certain circumstances. And that may be something that's going to have to get worked out. I don't know. We'll have to see. But certainly, I think what we've recommended to you here is going to cover the vast majority of circumstances that any judicial officer will face.
Judge Friedman?
I just have a minor question regarding recommendation number 29 in terms of the language in Canon 3E2. And in the last paragraph, I know it's the intent from what Judge McLaughlin said that the disclosure period shall be the latter of assuming office or 2 years after the date of the contribution. It doesn't say, alternatively, the date of receipt of the contribution, and in that last paragraph of the recommended change to Canon 3E2.
Terry, are you looking at the of the report that you
I'm
received?
I'm looking at page 6 of the materials that we received.
Okay.
And that last paragraph of the underlined language doesn't have the alternative language, and that, I'm sure you want it there.
That's true, and Chad is very happy that you've called that to his attention.
Good.
All right. Yes, Judge O'Malley.
Just another practical matter, kind of stressing what Judge Vicencia said. As a presiding judge, if you have a DA or a PD who's running for that position and receives that contribution, that would require the mandatory disqualification, there aren't a lot of places where you would be able to put those people if they wouldn't be able to hear the criminal matters, juvenile and family and those things. Usually you would want more experience on the bench to be able to make those very important decisions. Civil, kind of the same thing. So you've also taken them out of what would normally be an arraignment court misdemeanors to learn that judging kind of the job and making those decisions. So again, you've taken them out of that realm for 2 years, and it'd be very difficult also to put them in someplace else without more time on the bench and also required education.
Yeah,
to consider.
And we did talk about that. Internally within our task force, our conclusion was the contributions from PDs and DAs and APDs and so on, county council, would apply to the individual only and not to the office. But we think this is still something that should be the subject of the discussion by the advisory committee. But I happen to agree with you, and within the task force we did as well.
Thank you.
Chief, just a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Chief. What was the response with CJA with the automatic disqualification at the $1,500 limit?
You know, I've forgotten. My recollection is, Mike, that they agreed with that.
Actually, they didn't take a view of that. There was criticism of some of the implication of it, much of which was addressed. But there wasn't a particular there wasn't a position for or against. My personal view is that I appreciate it. I think bright lines help, especially in light of Caperton. Yeah, but that's my personal view, not the CJ.
If I didn't want a judge to hear my case, I would give him $1,500.
Right. And the other side could waive.
That's
the key. Yeah. I was asked that same question at Hastings, only the guy said, I want to donate $50,000 to Chin. And I said, the other side, well, please do. but the other side can waive it.
And when you said indirect contributions, too, you're talking about if family members, if someone gave $1,499, another family member gave the same thing, it's not an automatic disqualification. But if you consider that indirect method, it would be, would it not?
Well, that would appear to me to be indirect. That's correct. Okay. You get all members of one family, each of them gives you $375, and you put it together, you have something over the $1,500. This is an area, again, where we say we may not have a bright, clear line under for all circumstances. I would myself, and we would within the task force, have interpreted that as being, yes, indirect, and therefore requires the disqualification.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Bill?
I just wanted to observe, as to the task force as a whole in all four areas, all of the issues are complex and difficult in terms of coming up with strategies to avoid some of the consequences for the future, and implementing them is obviously even going to be more difficult. But I think both here and nationally, no issue has been more vexing than the financial issues in terms of trying to grapple with that in a meaningful way. And I remember talking to Judge McLaughlin when he first started in terms of what that committee was actually going to be able to discuss. And
Bill, for months, he had no recommendations.
I remember that.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah.
But I think at where we have come, I know at least in terms of the things that the Chief and Ron and I have been exposed to in our national meetings, that both the conversations as they have moved along and then the substantive trajectory of the recommendations are so far advanced of the things that we have heard in our national gatherings and other things, and I think it's just been contributed so much to the information that's available, the thought, and the analysis about how to grapple meaningfully and have substantive conversations on these issues, because it's been really hard to get to that level here in California and at the national level beyond the angst over the issues, but gee, there really isn't anything you can do. And so I just think, Judge McLaughlin, you and through your leadership and the members there, this has just been spectacular in terms of how it's advanced and the both advancing things for California but for the rest of the country on this issue.
Thank you. You know, part of our work, we did do a survey of all states as to what their requirements were in regard to contribution limits and just a broad range of information. And it's really confusing, but the one thing we did learn from looking at it is that no one has really done very much in this regard. And whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I'm assuming it is. Our consultant provided to us for our task force, Deborah Goldberg from the Brennan Center at NYU, did tell us at the end as we were wrapping this up that if we're able to get this done, that this would be the landmark, this would be the benchmark for the judiciary throughout the United States. So I'm hoping that that's what we're going to get.
So do I. Thank you.
Yes.
Chief, if it's appropriate, I would move to adopt the three recommendations, 29, 30, and 33. And I suppose if it's appropriate, then after we adopt it, to recommend that they go to the Supreme Court for review.
All right. Now, as I understand it, the overall recommendation here encompasses what you have put forth in your motion, endorsing the recommendations of those three items, 29, 30, and 33, and referring them to the California Supreme Court. But also the acceptance of the prioritization plan.
That's correct.
I want to make sure, is there anything else that you would urge be encompassed in a motion of approval here?
Not at this time. As you know from Justice Chin, we have a schedule coming back periodically, including a couple of more from my committee, one of which you may have noticed is missing, and that is the disclosure necessary for appellate court justices. And the only reason we didn't bring that to you here today, it would be the concomitant provision for the appellate courts with the trial courts, is that we want to get the advice of the appellate courts advisory committee on that before we bring it to you. But what we have here on the monitor, Chief, is what we're asking the council to do.
All right. So would your motion encompass all three elements: acceptance of the prioritization plan, endorsement of those three recommendations, 29, 30, and 33, and then reference to the Supreme Court for consideration by its advisory committee?
Yes, thank you, Chief.
And I would second that, Chief.
All right. Mr. Capozzi, any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Anything further, Justice Chin?
Nothing further, Chief. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for this vital and ongoing effort, and we look forward to further reports from you for implementation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. That brings us to the conclusion of our formal agenda, and there is information material encompassed, and there's one final thing that I will ask of you before we adjourn, and our staff has thoughtfully assembled the names of those judicial colleagues, all retired, who have passed on recently, and like to have us adjourn in memory of each of those individuals, and I will recount their names. Justice Donald Gates of the 2nd Appellate District, Judge August Accurso of the Municipal Court of Stanislaus, Judge John Boscovich of the Sacramento Superior Court, Judge Francis Gately from the Los Angeles Superior Court, Judge Janice Hayes of the Sacramento Superior Court, Judge Jean Monroney of the Butte County Superior Court, who also was a former council member, Judge Norman Reed from Stanislaus, Judge Gerald Schulte from Riverside, Judge Julia Sherman, also from Riverside, and finally Judge Richard Swan. So we honor them for their service to their courts and to the cause of justice with a moment of silence. And we are therefore adjourned, and we'll just hear some logistical announcements from Nancy Spiro.